Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Brian Mann. He's the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio, and he's been on the program previously because he's also a reporter for National Public Radio covering the opioid crisis. Today, however, we're going to talk about his home turf, the Adirondacks. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, before we get into the Adirondacks, WRVO is celebrating its 50th year, and you, I understand, are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Adirondack News Bureau at North Country Public Radio. So congratulations to you two.
Thank you very much. It's really been fun this summer, thinking back 20 years ago, coming here and knowing absolutely nothing. I'd heard of Adirondack chairs before, but that was the extent of my knowledge of this place. And so I've had 2 decades now to bone up.
So let's start with the park itself, thinking about the Adirondack Park. And it has a different feel, particularly upon entry, than other parks, things we associate with national parks. I mean, you do see a sign, but there's no gate that you go through. You don't pay a fee. The place is vast. It's composed of both private land and public land. So could you just throw out a few markers or figures that would give our listeners an idea about the basic contours of the area, what we're talking about here?
Sure. It is vast. It's about the size of the state of Vermont, 6 million acres. And within that big, we call it the blue line, because that's historically how the maps were marked. Within the blue line, there's this really complicated mix of public lands, wilderness areas, wild forest lands, wetlands and rivers and lakes. And also, interestingly, unlike most national parks or even state parks that people think of, mixed in there are dozens of communities. There are actually 130,000 people, including myself, who live inside the park. And that means we live surrounded by this extraordinary landscape. And it also means we live surrounded by this really intricate web of policies and laws and rules that make our lives quite different, where we have to sort of think about the park when we do things like building a house or changing a sewer line or stringing, you know, an electrical line between two communities. It all factors in trying to sort of have this relationship with this wild place where we live. And that experiment's been going on since the late 1800s. That's when New York State, this is still pretty unique in the world, New York State created a constitutional amendment. They call it the Forever Wild Clause. This is really beautiful language where these lawmakers way back then said, we are going to keep these lands forever wild. And so these protections are hardwired into this most basic constitutional document of New York State.
Interesting. You say 130,000. So the entire park, the population is about the same size as the city of Syracuse. So people can imagine spreading that city out into a place the size of Vermont. I've read that in terms of the visitors to the park, I've read that the park has more visitors per year than the Grand Canyon. What kind of impact has that been having on the area recently?
So there's a lot of really great news about the park, and we'll talk about that. This is a place that's gotten wilder. It's better protected now than it's ever been in its history. But one thing that is dramatic is that there's this phrase you hear in the park a lot, that it's being loved to death. A lot more people have discovered the place in the last decade. There are more hikers, more paddlers. You can go up on some of our most remote mountain summits, and it sort of feels like you're in Central Park. There are that many people crowded together, all looking for this experience of wildness and this wonderful, powerful thing of being in a wild landscape. And yet they wind up sort of with so many other people that experience is really muted. And as you noted at the top of the conversation, there is no real gate to the park. There are many different roads and highways and access points. And so what that means is it's much more complicated to think about how do you limit that use or how do you shape that use. And so this has become very controversial, very tangled, and Governor Andrew Cuomo and his administration have faced a lot of criticism over the decisions they've made and not made over limiting use of some of the most popular areas, especially in the High Peaks Wilderness, which is really this marquee landscape. Looks very Western, very grand, and that's where millions of people want to go But in many cases, it is just being overused.
Yeah, I want to get into some of the possible ways in which some balances might be tried or struck. But let me ask just another kind of informational question first. So is tourism the single biggest industry inside the park? Is that the main driver?
By far. That is the number one factor. It's a surprisingly diverse economy still for a rural area in America. There are still mines that operate in the park, which is fascinating, logging operations that go on. One thing that's controversial is we actually have a fairly large prison industry. State and federal prisons, for a variety of complicated reasons, have been located inside the park over the last half century. So tourism is not the only game in town. But yeah, if you come to the park, what you're mostly going to see is an economy driven by love of this landscape and people taking you rafting or offering you a hotel room or a restaurant place to eat. Guides and outfitters have really proliferated since I've been there. So tourism is certainly the number one force.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Brian Mann, a reporter for National Public Radio and the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio. So let's talk about the trails and the High Peaks area and how that's being managed more specifically, because a lot of people do come to the park to hike in some months and then ski in other months. I've hiked in the park. Algonquin is one of my favorite hikes. It's beautiful. It's steep, and I'm just wondering how people's engagement with that natural landscape of the park may have changed in recent years, particularly in the age of social media and the impact that might be having. I mean, do you have more people, for example, that kind of are hurrying in? They're trying to run up to the top of Mount Marcy or Algonquin or some other high peak and taking a selfie on the top and then booking out. You know, they've done that. They're done. They're on to the next thing.
Yeah, there is this kind of viral idea for some of our most scenic summits where people do clearly sometimes even want to get married and have their wedding photographs up there. And, you know, Instagram and Twitter, Snapchat, these are things that can make one summit into sort of a Disneyland ride very quickly. People want to rush in and experience that. And that's really, really problematic. There's actually one thing that's fascinating is there is this leave no trace movement in public lands and hiking communities. And one of the things that a lot of people in that Leave No Trace movement are talking about now is don't share photographs of these beautiful places. Leave no trace in that sense as well, because not because we want to keep them hidden or secret, but because we just don't want them to go viral in that unsustainable way. I will say two things. One is that these places are truly magical. And one of the things that will be sad is if we get to the point where they're either ruined or where people are really limited in their access. Fortunately, still, many, many weekends of the year, many days of the week, many seasons of the year, even the most popular trails can feel very remote. And people often ask me, you know, do you still go up Algonquin? Do you still hike on Marcy? And my answer is absolutely. I love going to those places. I spend a lot of time hiking those routes. I just don't do it on a holiday weekend. I don't do it when I know that the popular crush is going to be happening. And so that's one of the messages that is being put out there. We're going to be talking about regulation and perhaps a permit system. But there is also a lot of push for people just to make better decisions individually. When would be the right time for you to go and savor this experience? How can you do it in a way that's not going to overuse a trail? And I do think there are still those openings. You mentioned skiing. I love to ski these places. And in the wintertime, often I'll be in some of the places that are most overcrowded in the summer. And in the wintertime, I won't see another human being out there.
Yeah, you know, that what you said about the leave no trace and the connection of that then to not taking the selfie and putting it out on social media, that's really fascinating. And what popped into my head when you said that was it's changing the experience of something into the consumption of something. And maybe that's the thing that's trying to be preserved there. But let me ask you a question about finding that right balance between, you know, ensuring access, but then also preserving the wilderness aspect of the park. And have there been proposals then to try to limit the access in some way? I mean, I know the Adirondacks couldn't do what I'm about to describe, but I don't know if you've ever been to Baxter State Park in the middle of Maine. There's only a couple ways into that park, and they just count the number of people that are coming in any given day. And when they get to a certain number, they just close it off. That's it. But how have there been proposals to try to say, okay, we're only going to let so many people hike out of the Heart Lake area, or you know, wherever the gatekeeper might be?
Yeah. Right now, the closest we've come to that is that state officials have limited parking access. So along these really popular areas where people would park and head into the woods, they've narrowed the number of spots that are available. And somewhat controversially, they've been issuing tickets to people who park outside of those limited areas. And the goal is to say, hey, this is full. Go somewhere else where there's plenty of parking still. Just don't go to these marquee places. And so far, that's had marginal success. There have been policy ideas floated of having a permit system where you have to go online and say, okay, I want a ticket, essentially, to go this weekend, and that would fill up. And if there were no more passes available for that weekend, you would not technically be allowed to go. As you mentioned, the problem is that the Adirondack Park does not have, you know, sort of a narrow series of gateways. There are many roads in, many communities that sit at these access points, and nobody's really been able to figure out how to limit access in that way. The other problem I think people are wrestling with is that the Adirondacks have always had this very egalitarian, very open sort of sensibility. And so I think there is some pushback to this idea that it would feel like Baxter State Park or other parks around the world where you do have to reserve weeks or months in advance to go. It's part of the experience right now that I can leave work and I can park my car and be in the mountains anytime I want, and it feels very liberating. And so to add that layer of bureaucracy will be controversial, even if they can figure out a way to make it work practically. And so far, the Cuomo administration has really, you know, drawn a line and said, we're going to try a lot of other things before we pull the trigger on that.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Brian Mann. He's the Adirondack Bureau Chief for North Country Public Radio, and we've been talking about some of the issues in the Adirondack Park. So back to this issue of striking the right balance and protecting the wildness in the park, I suppose one way to think about it would be to say, well, if we can, in a sense, for lack of a better word, kind of sacrifice the wild aspect of the most highest traffic places in order to keep the rest of the park more wild, that might be one way to go. Are there things that have been done to try to increase the actual wilderness aspects of the area?
Yeah, one thing that is interesting is you do hear people in the park and who use the park who say, hey, it's great that most people go to a handful of trails. That leaves the rest of the park wild, truly empty, and this experience of remoteness for people who want to go for that kind of experience. That doesn't help these few trails. They're still getting hammered pretty hard and eroded and overused, so that's still going to be a problem. Another thing that New York has done, and it's going to be interesting, Grant, to see how this pays off, is that they've opened more wilderness areas. The High Peaks Wilderness, this most heavily used area, has grown dramatically over the last 5 years. More lakes added, more wilderness trails added. And so this is a really hopeful thing. And one of the hopes there is that people will say, okay, look, rather than going in at this trailhead like all the other thousands of people are doing today, I'm going to drive around here and enter through this new area and explore this new area. Mm. And so in this sense, the park has gotten bigger and it's gotten wilder. And maybe that will slowly help disperse some of the crowds.
I want to shift now to some questions about the area from a different perspective, thinking about aspects of the economy, service delivery, other kinds of issues. I've read that the proliferation of visitors and the proliferation now of short-term vacation rentals, again, you know, using the internet, that have popped up to meet that demand. I've read that that's created a lack of affordable housing in the general region for people who are actually trying to live there. First of all, is that true? And if it is true, does it create kind of other economic challenges downstream. I think, you know, like labor shortage may be one problem facing there. If no one who works in a trade can afford to live there.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And we do have a labor shortage in much of the Adirondack Park. Restaurants are closing for parts of the week or for parts of the day because they can't find people to come work. And a lot of it does have to do with that housing issue. So there's a real debate, especially around Lake Placid, over how to manage Airbnb-type rentals. The other thing that's really interesting is that these communities across the park, this 130,000 people population, like much of rural America, it is aging really fast, and the population in many areas is contracting. Schools are closing or consolidating. And so while in many ways the park itself, the landscape, they're healthier than they've ever been, no acid rain, really wonderful expansions of wild spaces, new lakes and rivers that are opening to the public for exploration. At the same time, we've seen the human community that's supposed to be part of the mix. From the very beginning, this experiment was supposed to include that human component. The communities are really, really struggling. And that's something we do a lot of reporting on and look at really closely. Some places, the grocery stores have closed. So you'll be living in the middle of this apparently very healthy landscape, and the local people can't find a place to buy fresh vegetables or a fresh gallon of milk. That is something that's troubling, complicated, and a lot of policy effort is underway right now to see if there's a way to sort of get that part of the economy better. Affordable housing might be part of the mix there. Better ways to keep the economy going year-round. Right now, like a lot of tourist communities, it tends to be very seasonal. Things get really sleepy here in the winter. Sometimes people describe it as sort of the dark side of the Adirondack Park, that along with the beauty, and along with this wonderful landscape, there is a lot of poverty. There are a lot of places where the population is shrinking, and I'm not really sure how that's going to play out. It's one of the things that's saddest for me is when I'm reporting on a town, I go back after 6 or 8 months and more businesses are closed, another house or two are empty, and that's a tough story to tell.
I've also read that the healthcare then would be related to some of these issues that you're talking about is also a challenge in the region, that the North Country and the Adirondacks in particular are particularly vulnerable to some of the proposed cuts that are being put forward now to the aid to hospitals, because they really depend on alternative sources of revenue.
Yeah, that's right. And it's already difficult here to find medical care. Often people, even who do have health insurance, often they drive long distances to, you know, kind of the micro cities on the edge of the park, places like Glens Falls or Watertown or Plattsburgh. That's the nearest place they can get dental care or find a nursing home when someone's elderly enough that they need that. So, yeah, there is this dimension. And again, this is a thing that's playing out in rural New York generally and rural America generally. But in the Adirondacks, it tends to be heightened that, in some places, for example, this is really troubling. The population has aged and dwindled to the point that they can't maintain their volunteer fire department or their volunteer ambulance squad. And so just that fabric of community life, there are more and more signs that it's fraying. And there are efforts to sort of shore that up. But so far, I haven't really seen anybody come up. It's sort of like we were talking about, how do you solve overcrowding on the trails? This is one of those ones that, as much as there's a great dialogue and discussion going on, nobody's really come up with kind of a silver bullet cure there.
What about broadband coverage? I would think that as remote work arrangements have increased, and also our reliance on the internet for entertainment, that might be another similar challenge.
It's really tough, and there has been a lot of effort to bring broadband into more parts of the rural Adirondacks. It's been successful in some communities. In some places, I think it has led to a small uptick in population and people being able to work from home and telecommute, that kind of thing. I think that's going to be a piece of the answer, but so far, even where they do have good broadband, you know, it's not a silver bullet. It's, more and more Americans, here's the simple truth, more and more young Americans in particular are choosing to live in urban or suburban places. And mm-hmm. the Adirondacks are really rural. I mean, you drive through central or western New York and you think, wow, this is really small town America. Well, when you get up into the Adirondack Park, I mean, you can drive easily in the wintertime. You can drive 45 miles and not see another human being, not see another car. It gets really empty out here. And that's just not where the culture of America is going these days. And so, you know, even when you have broadband and sometimes even when you have good jobs available, people are tending to say, you know, I would rather live near Albany, or I would rather go towards Syracuse or North Carolina or Florida. So that out-migration is something, you know, I don't know what the answer is. It's a big part of this story of rural America writ large that's just exacerbated here in the park.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Brian Mann from North Country Public Radio. So talk about the environment now, separate from the issue of the trail usage and the human, you know, boots going across all the different parts of the park. What are the other environmental challenges that the Adirondacks have been facing? You mentioned acid rain before as something that it sounded like you kind of put in the past there. If that's not one, what are some of the big ones that the park's facing?
Well, let me start by saying what's kind of interesting, which is the things that the park has managed to navigate through. One of the things that was happening when I first moved to the park 20 years ago was that the big chunks of privately owned land were generally held by massive timber companies, and they owned sort of vast hundreds of thousands of acres of the park. And those companies wanted to sell, and there was a lot of fear that they would be subdivided and turned into, you know, second home developments or vacation home communities, and it would really break up the forest canopy. And the park has dodged that bullet. A lot of that land has been added to the Forever Wild Forest Preserve. Much of the rest of it has been protected with what is called a conservation easement that prevents subdivision in those areas. And so 20 years later, it's remarkable how much wilder, how much more permanently protected the park is than when I moved here. We have also, at least for the time being, solved things like acid rain. There's some concern that it could come back now with some of the Trump administration's decisions about coal-burning power plants. But for now, at least, acid rain is not the concern that it was. So what's left? What are the big challenges that remain? I think the things that people are really talking about here are invasive species. Hmm. We are really struggling with creatures that are coming in from the outside. I was with a scientist at one of the most remote lakes in the park last year, a place that they've been studying it, and it had not biologically changed since the last ice age. It was really a time capsule of the North American continent pre-human, and all of a sudden, about 3 years ago, it was found to have a kind of jellyfish in it from Asia. Hmm. And that changed everything. The whole ecology of this little mountain lake, freshwater jellyfish had somehow arrived, and boom, the lake is altered forever. So invasives are a big challenge. And the other one, of course, just like everybody else, but maybe more sensitively here in the park, is climate. You know, as climate change hits, there's the potential for more forest fires. That could really change the makeup of the forest canopy. Trees like maples, which are iconic in the park, that really define, especially this time of year with the fall color, really define what the park is like. You know, it's possible that within a lifetime there will not be maple trees here, that will go to more southern stands of trees, oak and things like that. And so climate change is something that already people in the park are really talking and thinking about, and there's a lot of activism here around that issue. I would say, and when I talk to people, you know, what is the thing that you really think is going to hit the park the hardest? Climate is number one.
We've just got a couple minutes left, but I want to squeeze in a different topic here. I wanted to ask you a broader question about public radio and rural areas. You've been talking about, you know, rural areas more generally. You've written very eloquently, I think, about this topic of public radio and rural areas, that there's an irony or paradox between the stereotype of public radio, which has some truth to it, that it's driven by urban elites, often liberal urban elites, while at the same time, it's one of the only national media outlets that really takes a sustained more nuanced and authentically rooted, and you would be an example of this, look at those rural areas. And in fact, on the page that we have for this interview on the Campbell Conversations webpage on WRVO's site, WRVO.org, we're going to put the links to some of your articles there that I think speak to that. Just a couple minutes left, but I don't know. I don't know if there's a question in there somewhere, but maybe you can just comment on that apparent paradox that you've written about.
Yeah, I mean, telling the story of rural America turns out to be very, very, very important, not just for those of us who love it and who live here, but for America. It's part of our cultural heritage. It's politically important. And fortunately, public radio, uniquely in the media world of America, public radio lives here. We live in rural America. We have tiny little stations and reporters spread all across little towns from Alaska to New York to Vermont to Maine. And it's an experiment like no other, where we're all integrated. It's sort of like if you took every little small town newspaper in America and tied it into a big network. That's what NPR and public radio sort of accidentally did. And so, sure, we have a lot of Chicago Public Radio and This American Life and WNYC, and that's a lot of what people hear. But if you listen to the average All Things Considered or the average broadcast of Studio 360 or one of our other big national shows, you'll hear a reporter out there telling the story of some small town place, and often that reporter will be someone who lives there or who has deep cultural experience there. And I'm really proud of that, and it's something that I think matters in our storytelling. And so when people do occasionally mock us or attack us or critique us very broadly and say, oh, it's just New York City and Washington and the rest of us are in flyover country, it's not true for public radio. I live in what people would describe as flyover country. A lot of my colleagues in public radio live in flyover country. We love this place. We know it. We eat in the diners. We shop in the Piggly Wigglies. We send our kids to these little local schools. We go to these churches. And that helps us to tell that part of America's story. And as I say, I'm really proud of that fact.
That was Brian Mann. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
It's really fun, Grant. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.